The Book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WISO. I'm Vic McCumes. Back in 2014, I interviewed a guy named Chris West. It was his second appearance on the program. He's from England, and he had just written a book called History of America in 36 Postage Stamps. And I pulled out this interview because I've been thinking a lot about the U.S. mail and about the Postal Service, which at the time I did this interview 11 years ago was under a lot of threat because of financial problems. And those have only increased since we did this interview. And I think that the Postal Service is such an essential service in this country. And I have been a fan of postage stamps. So I really wanted to talk to him about this history of postage stamps in America. I became a stamp collector when I was in the second grade. I used to run errands with my mom. And she would take me various places. And one of her favorite places to go was a paint store. My mother was working on a mural in our house inside. She's an artist, and it was a picture of all the kids in the family that she was painting with house paint on the walls. So we went in this paint store all the time looking for the right colors of paint. And there was an elderly guy in there. At least I thought of him as elderly. I was in the second grade, so anybody over 20 was elderly to me. He's probably about the same age that I am now. Anyway, his name was Mark, and he was a really nice guy. And he would treat me like I was his peer, even though I was only in second grade and probably not that smart. He treated me like an individual, and he told me about his stamp collecting, and he got me really interested. And the third or fourth time we had a conversation about it, he went over to the cash register and he pulled out this really cool collectible postage stamp. And he said, "This is the beginning of your collection, Vic. I'm going to give you this stamp. And I hope you collect just like I have and enjoy it throughout your life." And I thank you, Mark, because that's exactly what I did. After that, I became such a stamp collecting nut. We had a lot of insurance companies in Des Moines. My dad worked at one, and I would ask my mom, "Could you drive me downtown? I want to see if I can find some stamps." And there were some stamp shops down there, but those were a little out of my price range in second and third grade. We would pull up in front of a big insurance company, and these were different times. I would go inside, and there would be these rooms full of women clacking away on typewriters, and every single one of them would have a wastebasket next to the desk, and it would be full of discarded envelopes. And all those envelopes had stamps on them. And so I would walk up to the desk, cute little third grader. I'd walk up to the secretary, and I'd say, "Hi, I have a stamp collection, and can I go through your wastebasket and pull out the envelopes with the stamps on them?" And, he's so cute, and all the secretaries would come running. And I got to rummage through all these wastebaskets, and I got hundreds of envelopes with stamps on them. And I still have those stamps. I love the U.S. mail. I love postage stamps. And I love talking to Chris West about his history of America and 36 postage stamps. Let's listen.
Chris, the last time we had you on the program was for your book, A History of Britain in 36 Postage Stamps, and you mentioned this project, and here it is. Here you are, and you've come back to America. Welcome back.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here. I love it.
How's it been going? How did it go with this research? Because you're a Brit, and the first book, you were writing about stamps that you were very familiar with and history that you were very familiar with, but for this one, you had to learn a lot of new things, didn't you?
I did. I had to learn a lot of new things. I think with the original one, though, I soon realized how little I knew, even of my own country's history. And so I had to do a lot of filling in of gaps. And with the States, I think most, I'm 60 now, most Brits of my age, there's a little bit of an American in all of us. We all grew up watching a lot of American TV shows. And, you know, we remember where we were when Kennedy was assassinated, and we watched those Apollo space missions and all those sorts of things. You know, we got into the sort of 60s stuff sort of from America. So, I mean, there's kind of American in all of us, really, inside. So, it was the same story in a way. There were gaps to be filled. The gaps were a bit bigger, let's put it that way.
Well, while you were fascinated with our space missions over there in Britain, we were over here rocking out to the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, so I guess it kind of went both ways.
Absolutely. Yeah, so it was a kind of great exchange, really, wasn't it?
It was. Chris, let's give our listeners an idea of the format, what you do with these books, because it's very similar.
Well, I've collected stamps for years, and I've got an American collection. What happened was I started collecting when I was a boy, and then I sort of lost interest. You do. You know, I was 16. Other things were interesting than stamps. 16. Later on, I came across the album again and thought, actually, these are beautiful, and they're interesting. And I started collecting again, and the more I collected, the more I became fascinated by the fact that each little stamp is a kind of tiny little time machine, little rectangular paper time machine. It can take you back into history. And that's really where the book came from. So I've chosen 36 postage stamps, which I think tell a story about an era in which the era that they come from. So that's the format. It is basically 36 chapters. Each one of them is headed with a postage stamp. And I then say, here's the stamp, and here's the story that it tells. And sometimes the story is more about the stamp itself. Sometimes it's more about American history at that time. Mostly it's a kind of interweaving of all of them.
I started collecting stamps when I was just a boy, and one of the first things I learned about American stamps is that there weren't any before 1847 as far as being issued by the U.S. government. And you start off with your history at the beginning of American history pretty much, but there were no stamps, so you figured out a clever way to make that work. Tell us what you did.
Well, here I'm sitting in Boston at the moment. So, I mean, you really have to start American history with the Revolution and the War of Independence and Declaration of Independence and all that. So you just, British history is a bit like one of these sort of... I've just been on this circular trip around Boston on a trolley bus thing, and British history is a bit like that. You can get on at any point and get on off at any point. But American history so obviously starts at that point that I had to begin there. So I thought, what am I going to do? I want to choose stamps from the era. You could always get an old stamp with George Washington on and sort of stick it in there and say, and now I'm going to talk about George Washington. But I wanted to have a stamp from its actual era. But luckily, one of the movements that set off the revolution was a thing called the Stamp Act in 1765. This is too good an opportunity to miss, really. So I have cheated a bit. I haven't put a postage stamp in to start with. I've put in the British government revenue stamp. But it's a stamp, and it was one of the incendiary moments of the revolution when suddenly people had to pay this taxation on any printed matter. It had to have this stamp on it from the government, which they had to pay a tax. And this is where the whole no taxation without representation came from. 1765, the Stamp Act. Okay, then we got a bit of a gap to 1847, and I have to say I cheated. Mm. I just said, here's a stamp with George Washington on, and I'm going to talk about George Washington, and then here's Jefferson, here's Andrew Jackson. You can't miss these guys out. They're so important. When I give a talk, I do kind of slightly jump over that bit, because I know it's a little bit of a cheat, but for the book, it had to be. I had to have these guys in. So I've cheated a bit. When we get to the Civil War, then we've caught up. The narrative has caught up with the stamps. You've got Jefferson Davis on the Confederate States stamp, and from then on, every stamp is from its era. So I did cheat a little bit, but you've just got to in order to make the narrative start at the right place.
Well, I thought it was brilliant that you started off with this stamp from George III of Great Britain, the revenue stamp of 1765, and your title of that essay is Liberty, Property, and No Stamps. And you've got this beautiful, beautiful stamp that you borrowed the image from the Smithsonian National Postal Museum. So let's talk some more about some of these stamps. You've got some really beautiful ones in here, and you also tell us how many times certain people's images appeared on stamps. And one very popular one, of course, is someone who's considered by many to be our greatest president, Abraham Lincoln. You've got the Abraham Lincoln 15 Center from 1866, and this is also goes to explain that they don't put living people on American stamps.
Well, they didn't used to. Of course, the rule might have been broken now because we've had these Harry Potter stamps, and there's what's his name? I can't remember his name now. The young boy who does the acting. They don't put living. It's been a rule. It was an unwritten rule until the 1880s, and then suddenly it became a kind of rule that we don't have living people on stamps. The Lincoln stamp, tragic stamp, obviously, it came out exactly a year after his death on April the 14th. Black color of mourning, sad face-looking Lincoln on it, terrible, terrible tragedy, my God, it was an awful thing to happen.
Mm.
And just when his nation needed him so much, it just made so much difference. Because he could have healed the wounds, I think. I don't think anyone else could. Nobody else did. Awful things happened after that. Lincoln, I think, could have made a difference. But sadly, that was not to happen.
I think one of the most beautiful stamps is this one you have for Dance of the Ghosts. And you're talking about that late 19th century in America and how the frontier was gone. And you have this beautiful picture, but apparently these Western cattle in the storm weren't actually in America, were they?
They weren't American. It's the most beautiful series. It's the 1898 Trans-Mississippi Exhibition set of stamps, which I think is my favorite American commemorative set of stamps ever. Beautiful designs, sort of frames around the stamps, like I call Raymond Ostrander Smith. In the sort of Beaux-Arts style that was popular at the time. And in between that, in the middle of these frames, are these lovely images of the Old West. And the one I feature in the book is a stamp which is sometimes quoted the most beautiful American stamp ever, and it's called Western Cattle in a Storm. You see these cattle charging through a kind of gulch. There's a slightly odd story to it, because they're Western, but it's Western Scotland rather than Western America. It was actually taken from a picture by a Scottish artist, and those cattle actually are sort of 40 miles north of Glasgow rather than out in the American West. But it's a beautiful stamp, so I mean, and it's a lovely series. What it is, of course, is already it's a mythology, that series, because by 1898 the Old West is pretty much gone, and it shows things like a Native American hunting a buffalo. Well, there weren't any buffalo left by then, but it's still a beautiful series.
Well, we're wonderfully consistent in this country, having those Scottish cattle on one of our stamps, and we're actually recording this on Election Day in America, and there's a senatorial candidate out in Iowa who has been closely associated with the pork industry, and in one of her campaign pieces, she supposedly had a picture of a pig, but it was a Danish pig. The picture was taken in Denmark, so... We've been doing this. Yeah, we're very consistent here in America.
You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. My guest back in 2014 was an Englishman named Chris West. He'd written a book that was a history of American postage stamps, 36 of them. But as you heard, they weren't all stamps. He had to get clever about stamps before 1847 because there were no U.S. postage stamps before that date. And we'll continue our conversation on 91.3 WYSO Community-Owned Public Radio for curious listeners right after this. You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. And the Book Nook comes your way every Saturday morning at 7 o'clock and every Sunday morning at 10:30, and they're entirely different programs. And you can only hear the Book Nook on WYSO. And as we look at the beauty and the value of public broadcasting, think of that only here on WYSO, where we love bringing you lots of locally produced programs. And this one was originally recorded back in 2014 when I was talking to Chris West about his history of America in 36 postage stamps. Let's listen.
You have another really wonderful stamp from the Panama Pacific Exposition commemorative series. It's the picture of the Panama Canal, and the subject line is Bully for TR. And we're, of course, referring to Theodore Roosevelt, who got that Panama Canal project done.
Yes, I mean, I'm a great admirer of Theodore Roosevelt. I think he was obviously a sort of larger-than-life character, but he took on the big trust and big business, and he understood that the government's job was to govern and to look after the people, and he really was a great innovator at the time, because beforehand, and also he made the presidency important again. After Lincoln's assassination, there was a long period when presidents were not really very effective, and TR came charging in, and he was the youngest man ever to be president. He came charging in with that youthful energy and took things up, because there had been a kind of creeping sense of fewer and fewer people owning more and more of the nation's wealth at the end of the 19th century. And he came in and did something about it, and he prevented the monopolies holding their power, did stuff about, like, the food industry. It was completely unregulated. All sorts of appalling things were put in the food. If you ever read Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, it's all in there. And Roosevelt, he sorted this out. He was a great man.
I read The Jungle in high school, and I was appalled. My guest is Chris West. His book is A History of America in 36 Postage Stamps, and many of these essays also give us some great postal history. And I think my favorite anecdote was the one about this family that shortly after they brought in parcel post service and all the mail was traveling on trains, they wanted to send their daughter somewhere, but they couldn't afford a train ticket. So they put some stamps on her and they mailed her.
That's right. That's right. And they couldn't, the authorities couldn't say no. I think they did bring in some regulation after that. But, you know, the guard sat her down in the mail carriage, and she sort of sat and chatted to him as the train made its journey, and then he sort of waited till the grandparents arrived at the station, and that was that.
And she was only 5 years old, right?
She was only 5 years old. That was not a very kind thing to do, but
I was trying to picture if they put the stamps on her forehead or how that worked.
Yes, I often wonder. I imagine they stuck them on her forehead, I think. Yes, exactly. It's a very good question, though. Why on earth they did put the stamps on her hands? I don't know. Who knows?
Well, I'm a great admirer of the Postal Service, and I'm sure that she probably had a wonderful time riding in the mail car.
I bet she did. Time of her life, I think. It's really nice. That's the charm of it all, really. The whole thing was handled with good humor.
Our postal service here in the United States is somewhat under threat these days. As a Brit, as someone from another land, do you have any observations about that? Do you think that things are going to improve, or what do you think might happen?
Well, I wish the postal service well. This is largely a political matter, as far as I can see. Back in 2006, Congress came up with some sort of command that the post office should put huge amounts of money aside to meet future retiree health benefits, much more than you would expect from an ordinary business, because they said, well, sorry, the level of post is going down. You're going to, you've got to assume you're going to sort of quietly wither away, and therefore you've got to put all this money aside. But, I mean, that's like a sort of sentence of death, really. I think that it's very foolish. So I think, and the moment the Postal Service is fighting to get control of its own destiny. It's too political. It's too much of a political football at the moment. And I think whatever can be done to make it autonomous again, so it can set its own prices and basically run itself. Because it's half a government organization, half a private organization. Well, not private, but sort of independent, and it's just sort of, it's flailing around a bit, but it's not its fault. It needs money, it needs investment. The CFO, last time they made a public announcement, said we need $10 billion because our fleet is getting out of date. And the government turned around and said, well, you can't have anything. But it's really got to be, it's a mess.
Hmm.
But it's a political mess. It needs political solution to it. It's not just a question of giving these guys a kick up the bum. It's impossible for them at the moment because of the politics.
Well, the infrastructure is there. We have this wonderful service where you can stick an envelope into a mailbox and a couple days later it's delivered in California or New York City. It's just an amazing service.
Absolutely. Exactly.
I hope it survives because I just can't imagine a world without it.
It is up to our politicians to sort it out, really. The post office has a quite clear set of requests from the politicians. So I had a chat with one of their people about this because I think it's such an interesting issue, and they have about 9 requests that they want politicians to sort out to let them get on with their job. And you know, if those were all sorted, it might be a case that a private investor can take a stake, but it would have to be the right sort of private investor, a proper business committed to the delivery of post rather than somebody going back to the sort of gilded age and things, who just wants to make a load of money out of it. Got to be someone who cares.
Hmm.
But that's another option.
Yeah. Chris West joins us. His book is A History of America in 36 Postage Stamps. We had him on the program previously for his book that came out before this, A History of Britain in 36 Postage Stamps. And he's come over from the UK on a book tour for this book, and he's joined us on the telephone in Boston today. You closed the book with a very funny stamp, I thought, but it's also a stamp that is very accurate.
Thank you. Yes, it sounds terribly sort of immodest. After having shown pictures of George Washington and Abraham Lincoln and things, I end up with a picture of myself because you can do that now. You can contact a company called stamps.com and send in a picture of yourself, and back comes a stamp, which is legally valid. You can stick it on an envelope, send it off to your friends, which is kind of very bizarre in a way. But in another way, it's sort of, you know, it's democracy at work, you know. All men are created equal, so we can all be on a stamp. It's rather fun in a way.
These are actually strictly regulated. Now, you could go out and you could order that stamp with your face on it. But if I wanted to order some with your face on it, they would say no because I don't have permission to use your image. And I know this through experience. I had a photo of myself with an author, and I didn't think this author was particularly well known. And so I sent the image in to one of these stamp companies, and I said, yes, I'd like to order some stamps. And they wrote me back, and they said, well, the guy you're with is, and then they knew who he was. They identified. They said, you don't have the right to use his image. I was kind of bummed out.
Oh, it was a shame, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, well, there we go. I didn't know that. That's interesting.
They apparently have some sort of image identification software where they can actually identify people in photos. And so I sent him a picture of myself, just myself, like you did. And I said, okay, I'd like some of these on a stamp. And they wrote me back, and they said, who is this person? Do you have the right to use this person's image? And I said, well, it's me.
I wonder what would have happened if you'd have had 2 people on a stamp, you and, I don't know, your wife or next-door neighbor or, I don't know, postman or something, whether they'd have picked up. I don't know. It's interesting.
Kind of makes you wonder.
Yeah. We'll find out.
As we get into the modern age, I kind of stopped collecting American stamps once they all became adhesive. But these beautiful stamps from the past, you get into the history of the design. One in particular, which is sort of an ironic one, is the Cold War chapter, the NATO Force Center from 1959, the work of an artist named Stephen Dohaenos. You actually tell us who designed a lot of these stamps, and some of these are really beautiful.
Yes, he was he's a lovely artist, actually. He was quite sort of folksy sort of artist. He did pictures for Picture Post and things like that. Pictures, I can't remember. He did stuff for magazines and things, and they tended to show sort of rural American life with sort of families and Christmas trees and all that sort of thing. And for him, the mail was a great symbol of connection. The mail of the post was a symbol of connection, of community. And he would show rural post offices and things. And he was very keen on this metaphor, which I think is still important. It's why, I mean, in a sense, going back to what we were talking about earlier, that the postal service needs to survive as a link to everybody in America, rather than just, you know, serving big cities and that sort of thing. He understood this very well. But, of course, one of the stamps he designed was this NATO stamp. And, of course, while NATO is a very admirable organization, I'm glad it exists, it is testimony to a terrible global event at that time, which was the ongoing Cold War, which was horrific. And those of us... I find it sort of scary that my daughter learns about the Cold War in history lesson. I think, well, I grew up through that.
Yeah.
But it was a terrifying time. I mean, you know, they had enough weaponry to blow us all up, God knows how many times. It's a terrifying historical era in some ways.
And that
stamp is a kind of strange irony that it's about the Cold War, but at the same time it is designed by this artist whose heart was very much in small communities and the connection of human individuals.
The Cold War began right after World War II ended, and President Harry Truman had taken over after the death of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was a hardcore stamp collector. FDR had apparently about 1 million stamps in his collection, and he was very involved in stamp design. And one of the things that he liked to do was get out his message. We have just enough time to talk a little bit about stamps as propaganda.
Right. Well, I mean, obviously, FDR was the great king of stamp and propaganda. He was a collector himself and was also obviously a great political radical, and he understood the need that stamps can bring messages into people's lives. He wanted stamps to be bright and clear and have upbeat messages, and he did some designing himself. He certainly took a lot of interest in the design process. And he said, and I think there are some very nice stamps from his era because of that. And stamps have always been propaganda, I suppose, and they always will be. They're always, every time a stamp, especially overseas, if a stamp from another country lands on a doorstep, it is sending a little message about that nation to other nations. And I think especially in the modern world where spin and sort of hearts and minds are important, I think stamps can play a bit of a role in that, really.
Mm.
We can present ourselves as a positive, civilized, cheerful nation. That's a good thing.
Chris West joins us. His book is A History of America in 36 Postage Stamps.
You've been listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, and that was Chris West, his second appearance on the program back in 2014. And the first time he was here was for his history of Great Britain in postage stamps, and really great books. He's never been on the program since, but at the time, in 2014, he actually had a couple of events that we were publicizing. He was going to be in Delphos, Ohio, and then he was going to be in Fort Wayne, Indiana, where he had an old friend that he'd known since he was a teenager. And he had these events, and so we were helping him get the word out, which is what we do here on public radio. We get the word out, let you know about things you might not have known about, and try to entertain, inform, and maybe even turn you on to something that you never heard of before. And speaking of things that you might be very familiar with, coming up we're going to bring a special bonus segment, a tribute to a colleague of mine here at WYSO, who is retiring from the airwaves very soon. Stay tuned. The Best of the Book Nook continues on WYSO. And it's kind of a bittersweet time because Bill Felker, who's been on the air here for a number of years with Poor Will's Almanac, is retiring from the airwaves. And I just want to go back and pull out an interview I did with Bill. We've done a number over the years, and I want to bring you one of his classic interviews where we got to hear just what a brilliant guy he is, and entertaining as well. And when I first came to Yellow Springs in 1993, I became a Bill Felker fan right away, because the Yellow Springs News has had the print version of his almanac, and they continue to do so. And in fact, the Dayton Daily News also has his almanac, and I am in the same section with him with book reviews every Sunday. So I've been a great admirer of Bill and his dulcet tones on the radio and his wonderful writing and his sense of humor. And I keep hoping that he's going to put out his book about outhouse humor, because I would really love to read that. And during this interview, Bill talked about that possible book, and I hope he's working on it right now. Let's listen now to Poor Will's Almanac conversation we had for one of the almanacs a number of years ago, back in 2016. Here's Bill Felker on the Best of the Book Nook.
I've had farmers in Wyoming, of all places, say that my weather forecasts are the only ones they trust. I couldn't believe it when I said it, or when I heard it, but that's a fact. I had somebody just 2 days ago write me and say, I've got to have thyroid surgery. What's the best time to do that? And, I told him what the moon said, and that's all I could say. I said, get a good doctor, and say your prayers and relax. Think positively.
Would that be the new moon that you suggested?
Well, I was suggesting that he had have his surgery either between full and new moon on either end, right? So either as the moon enters its second quarter or its fourth quarter. That's traditional lunar lore, it's not original by any means. So
you're giving advice in all different areas there. My guest is Bill Felker. His Poor Will's Almanac 2017 just came out. You mentioned the nicotine thing and how that avoidance of nicotine led to other pastimes. And wasn't a barometer also involved?
Well, yeah. Back in 1973, my wife gave me a barometer for Christmas, and I sort of bonded with it right away. I set it up so that the needle would move. They didn't have digital things, of course, back then. And lo and behold, I could graph it. And if anyone does that, and maybe I was different that way in that I became obsessed with graphing, but it's really fun. And you can tell when a high pressure comes through because the graph goes up. And when the low pressure is approaching, you can see it. And what was really interesting is how from year to year, the patterns were similar. And that's what the weather forecasts in this almanac are based on, that the world breathes in a relatively regular way. And so what happens with weather is that the graphs create a fractal pattern. And a fractal pattern is not an identical pattern. So you can't forecast exactly what the weather is going to be like. But fractals are self-similar patterns. And so, the equinox cold front was a little late this year, reaching here in Ohio, but it came on schedule pretty much. It's a little late. Okay, sometimes it's a little early, but you can kind of depend on that. I think most people who live in one place for a while kind of expect certain things to happen at certain times, but you can put it on graphs too. It's fun.
Yes, we had a kind of a hot September. In fact, we had kind of a hot, humid summer.
Mm-hmm.
And they say that the last 2 years have been some of the hottest years ever. Does this change any of these forecasts and predictions, this heat that some people say isn't really anything to worry about?
I think it's interesting from my perspective that the fronts continue to come through in their own fractal way, but the characteristics of the fronts can change. And, we've had hot summers like this before and warm autumns. from a local standpoint, and, you know, my scientific center is my backyard, so, you know, I don't claim that it's in any way valid scientifically, but, you know, it appears that things have changed. I remember when I moved to Ohio in 1978, and this is a very anecdotal perspective, but the winters were awfully gloomy. And over the years, that's little by little changed. And so the winters in southwestern Ohio are much less dim and gray and gloomy.
Less cloud cover, huh?
Yeah, less mm-hmm. cloud cover. And, you know, I think the jury is out on how all of these global temperatures affect your backyard. Mm-hmm. And that's why we need folks out there stopping smoking and obsessively taking notes, because right. unless you look, you don't see.
You take the long view. My guest is Bill Felker. When you're out of town, Bill, do you have somebody run over and look at your barometer for you and take measurements?
No. It's really wonderful traveling anywhere, because you can gauge where you are based on what the foliage is doing. I went up to Rochester, New York last week, and it's fun to watch. I left southwestern Ohio. Everything was green. And little by little by little, above Cleveland and then east, you could see the season gradually turning the leaves. By the time we got to Rochester, there was definitely a hint. We stayed there 2 days, and on the way back, in 2 days, the hillsides had turned into a really early autumn. Wherever you travel, you can see changes like that. And the cool thing is that what I saw in Rochester is going to happen here in southwestern Ohio next week. Uh-huh. It's cool. So you're watching time in space. Space is the key to time. And you can apply all of these things in the almanac to different places that way and say, oh, I just drove from late summer into early fall.
You have so many plants in this almanac. Are these all plants that you have learned by walking around outside to identify them?
Yeah, they are. They're all, since I'm based in southwestern Ohio, they're all from around where I live, and you can find them almost everywhere in the East Coast. I mean, it depends, east of the Mississippi. I don't know. I didn't count them. But there are a lot of them, and people say, well, you know, I go on a wildflower walk, and the guide, you know, points out this, that, and the other thing. And, of course, it's hard to remember that. And then you say, well, yeah, it was fun, but I don't remember anything. But if you do it one by one, you know, first you quit your addictions, and then you've got to get out there. And then little by little, you say, oh, okay, my gosh, it's a trillium. What kind of trillium is it? Mm-hmm. And so suddenly you've made that your own, and then it goes on from there. And everybody can do a dandelion. That's good. So it's like having a life list of things, right?
Well, I like the way you have that feature in each month where you say, if the trout are running in – that's just a paraphrase.
Right,
if the trout are running in eastern Oregon, then the lilacs have just begun to bloom in southern Wisconsin, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. How do you put all that together?
I put it together, first of all, from the baseline that I use from my daily notes, which is, I don't know, 500,000 words or so, you know, all kinds of notes from different days. And then from travels I've made, not extensive travels, but and also from readings.
Okay.
So it's kind of fun to mix them up in a stew, mm-hmm. and say, well, you know, when frogs and toads are migrating in Indiana, then the horseshoe crabs are coming ashore in southern Georgia. Something like
right,
that, right?
Right. Uh-huh.
And you're putting together a stew which shows, in my opinion, shows how everything is connected and how you can apply one thing to another. Because you're not, even though this is totally parochial, you're not parochial, because you can apply it to other places.
when we've gone through a long period of drought in the summer and it hasn't rained in weeks, and then we get a little rain and you get that scent of petrichor in the air, and you see all the toads are out.
Mm-hmm.
When you talk about migrating toads, what do you mean when they migrate? Are they just migrating across the yard? How far do they go?
You know, I don't know. I've got notes that show that in my casual observation that I see more toads in August and September. And I, you know, every once in a while I think about these notes and I say, you know, I wonder if this is a coincidence. And so, you know, we've got the internet now. We can look that up. And indeed, frogs and toads are migrating at this time of the year. And apparently what they do is they find just the right place and they dig in. Mm-hmm. They dig into the soil and they stay there for the winter. So it's fun to find that the casual observations that you make just walking around indeed play out. You say, I wonder if such and such is true. And if you saw it, it probably is true. Now, what does that mean? Well, you know, what does a frog and toad migration mean?
Mm-hmm.
It means you're connected. You're watching. You're seeing what's happening around you. And, you know, if you don't, then you get the sixth great extinction, right? If you don't see it, you don't care about it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't care about it, well, who cares?
Yeah. Well, the whole extinction theme, I don't even want to go there, but I hate digging in the yard in the winter. But sometimes you have to. Sometimes your cat died or you have some reason you have to go out there and dig. And on a number of occasions, I have excavated a toad down there and it just breaks my heart. I mean, I quickly put the dirt back, but I'm like, you know, it's not right. I've tampered with this toad's wonderful little underground cavern, and I hope that they make it. But, you know, here I've opened it up to the cold air. It shakes me up. And we have such an impact on nature all the time. And you have these wonderful little reader-contributed pieces that close out each month.
Mm-hmm.
And one in particular, I've got to admit, I was appalled by the woman who killed the rooster.
Those are pretty classic farm rooster stories. I don't know how many of those people have contributed. Sometimes it's a turkey. Sometimes it's an evil goose that chases the young child as he or she goes to the outhouse. And yeah, those birds always end up on the table.
You know, and they taste so good. Right?
They taste so good because they're, you know, this is the retribution.
Right. Yeah, you do have a good outhouse story in there, the one about the aunt that likes to smoke in the outhouse.
Mm-hmm.
I shouldn't even be giving these away. These are a real treat on the end of each chapter. How do you get them?
Well, I started doing the weekly almanacs in 1984. And the following year, I started asking for reader stories. And I don't know how many I've gotten through the years, at least in almost 1,000 probably. I've never really counted them all. But, people have all kinds of things to share. And outhouse stories are classics, and I'm hoping to put them all together into a collection this year, you know, the outhouse stories of Poor Will's Almanac, because they're really great Americana.
You've got that many of them?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's not going to be a heavy volume, but
wow.
I can probably put together 100. That's a special.
That'll make for some great outhouse reading.
Well, yeah, you know, you just, well, people tell me they put Poor Will's Almanac in the bathroom, you know, hey, if you put the outhouse stories there, that'd be even better.
Truly.
You've been listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, and that was Bill Felker. One of a number of conversations we've had on this program over the years. That was recorded back in 2016. We were talking about the current edition of Poor Will's Almanac at that time. And it's been such a pleasure to have Bill here on WYSO for all these years as we say goodbye. He's signing off the program.
And just been so great to work with Bill. What a wonderful man. And I love his almanacs. I love his observations, his meditations, his reflections. And I know you do too. And he's still in print. You can still read his almanac in the Dayton Daily News every Sunday, and also in the Yellow Springs News every week. Thanks, Bill, for all you have done on WISO over the years. And we began the program with Chris West, an interview I did back in 2014 for his History of America in 36 Postage Stamps. And as I mentioned in my introduction, I'm a stamp guy, and I'm a big supporter of the U.S. Postal Service. I think it's crucial. I think it should be subsidized by the government. I don't think it should be profitable necessarily. It's a service. I don't think it's about making a profit. It's about delivering letters to people everywhere in the country at all locations, not just locations that are convenient for private enterprise to make a profit on. And what a value it still is. Even though postage rates have gone up, it's still an incredible value. For less than a dollar, you can send a letter to anybody in the United States. And if we all did our part, if we all mailed just a letter or postcard every single day, that could make the difference for the U.S. Postal Service. I do it. I write a postcard or a letter every single day. I buy stamps at the post office. I support the Postal Service. And I'm a former postal worker. I know what it's like. I was a postal clerk back in Des Moines back in the day. And I didn't particularly like my bosses there, but I sure like sorting the mail. And at about 3 o'clock in the morning, when that bag would come in from the airport with all those postcards from Europe, bundles of them, we would fight over them because we got to sort those postcards. I got to look at all the pictures. And of course, I never read the messages. I would never do that because that would not be a good thing, would it, to read private messages on postcards? I mean, that'd be like snooping in somebody's email account. For the Best of the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. It's always a pleasure to be here with you. And thanks for tuning in. And please, think about mailing a letter or postcard every single day, like I do.